payment would be $35 million per year for 10 and 11. You're looking at special revenue funds of about $2 million, game and fish fund of about $2.8 million, natural resources fund of $11 million, and general fund of $6.7 million in funding for 10 and 11. And just to talk about the actual operating budget of lands and minerals, it's only $20.8 million. So of that $57.4 million, this is actually what the Division of Lands and Minerals allocates for their activities, spending after PILT payment is transferred over to the Department of Revenue. Of this, $10.2 million, or 49% of their budget, is used for real estate management services. $1.4 million is to develop our improved land record system. Those are internal funds that we're using to bring that program up to speed. $3 million for mine land reclamation, and $6.2 million of a biennial budget from the minerals management, for minerals management. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Director Vadas to talk about specific questions related to the division and get into the change items, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Marty Vadas, and I'm the Director of the Lands and Minerals Division. And on this slide, just to remind you, the three major responsibilities for lands and minerals. The first one is to manage mineral activities on about 12 million acres of state-owned land. And just for your information, about 80% of all iron that's mined in the U.S. comes from Minnesota. That's been historic and continues on into the future. And Minnesota ranks third nationally in horticultural peat production. The next major responsibility is mine land reclamation regulations, and that's for taconite and for peat operations. And that affects about 250,000 acres of land in Minnesota that's under permit. The department also has responsibility for permit to mine for non-ferrous operations as well, but there are none of those in operation yet. And the third major area is real estate management transactions on about 5 million acres of state-owned surface. And along with that, then, fiscal 08 acquired about 57,000 acres of conservation easements and acquired about 14,000, just under 15,000 acres in fee title. Next slide, give you an idea of kind of what's happening in the minerals world. This slide shows the prices over the last 10 years or so for some major mineral commodities. And I just point this out that the markets really are in flux. Some of the metals like gold and iron continue to have a very good price. But some metals like copper and nickel, shown on this slide, peaked in a couple of years ago and now are down. But I think the next slide will show the exploration activity. And so this slide shows mineral exploration drilling that's been done in the state of Minnesota for about the last 8 or 9 years. And the last couple of years reflect that big increase in metal prices that we saw. In fiscal or calendar year 08, that represents 72 miles of bedrock drilling that's been done in the state. Kind of contrast that with 2002, where there was about 3,500 feet of exploration drilling. And that little inset shows the companies that are doing this exploration and the number of holes. And it's been very busy in exploration, very active over the last couple of years.
Mr. Vadas, is the location for the drilling changed very much, or is it all pretty much around where the mine sites that we've heard the most about are?
Madam Chair, I don't have a map that shows that, but in general, the Teck, Duluth Metals, Encampment, and Franconia are all drilling in that Ely to Babbitt, Duluth Complex area, that copper-nickel area. Kennecott is a company that's drilling in Aiken County. And so that's away from the kind of the historic drilling that's been done in Minnesota in really a totally new area. And it's near a little town named Tamarack.
Do you have any information about the results they're getting there?
Madam Chair, on all state mineral leases, the companies have to turn over the drilling results with the assay information as soon as they receive them. So we have all that information. The lease holds it confidential until the lease is dropped. So we have the information in our files.
But you couldn't tell us, or you'd have to kill us.
Well, there have been public announcements, and the public announcements made by the companies just indicate just a tremendous size of copper-nickel resource in the Luth complex. And Kennecott has made some public announcements over what they've been finding, and they have a extremely high-grade intercept of copper and nickel in Aiken County, on the order of 10 times higher than what we're seeing in the Duluth complex as far as metal grades go, and over quite a good thickness. And so that's a very high-grade deposit that they're drilling on. They're not calling it a mine yet because they need to do more drilling. They need to figure out the size of this area, but very, very good grade.
Okay, go ahead, please.
Another trend is more related to the surface management activities that DNR does. We are seeing a real expansion of infrastructure for things like power lines and pipelines, and how that impacts DNR is these facilities need to cross state-owned surface, and also there are water crossings. And so there are licenses that are issued for all these pipelines and power lines. And one of them, I think it's the Alberta Clipper, it's called, comes from the oil sands area of Canada and comes down to Duluth. And there are many, many more that are being talked about in the future, mostly pipelines and power lines. So just a kind of an overview of what the objectives are, what we're going to talk about here. It's the mineral management, mine land reclamation, real estate, and land records. I'll talk a bit about where we're at with that project. So the first one here is mineral management, and the direction here is to benefit the Permanent School Fund, University Trust Fund, local government by leasing tax forfeit land, and the state owns about 12 million acres of mineral rights in total. That represents trust fund and tax forfeit mineral rights. And so just shown on this slide are the kinds of supporting programs that we have at DNR in order to manage these minerals, lease them, generate income for the trust funds, and ultimately see that these lands are reclaimed. Next.
Excuse me, Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Vias, could you give us some idea of when we say the benefit of permanent school trust fund, permanent university fund, what we're talking about in dollars?
The next few slides, I think, might help
tell us
answer that?
Thank
question.
You.
But so you're right on. The next slide shows the mineral revenue from all sources for the last few years. And on this slide, you can see the permanent school fund is the light blue color. The university trust fund is that darker blue color, and also shown on here then are tax forfeit and other kinds of mineral rights. So the majority of the income has gone to the school trust fund and the university trust fund. And if in fiscal 08, it was around $31 million, but in calendar year 8, it was $37.4 million. So a tremendous amount of income from minerals, and this next slide I think gives kind of a historical perspective. This is the iron ore and taconite revenues from 1890 to 2008. So 1890 was the first mineral lease on state-owned land, and as you can see, the last several years, the income is up dramatically from what it has historically been. And this just shows the iron ore and taconite, but that's 98% or so of all the mineral income is from that source. So the objectives then are continue to manage the minerals and looking for the state industry investment to look at funding research. And so there are a couple of programs, minerals diversification, looking at other kinds of minerals in Minnesota that may potentially return something to the school trust funds. And also there's a cooperative research program looking at reducing the costs, reducing energy consumption, and improving quality at taconite operations. The next program objective is mine land reclamation. And DNR enforces the mine land reclamation regulations for ferrous, non-ferrous, and peat. And as I mentioned, that currently covers about 250,000 acres of land in Minnesota. And listed here then is the out of statute, the direction for mine land reclamation and what the goals are, what we're supposed to achieve. It's looking at controlling adverse environmental effects of mining, preserving natural resources, planning for the future utilization, and promoting the orderly development of mining. And so the kinds of programs that we have supporting that is we do mine permitting. We have reclamation compliance inspections. We're involved with environmental review for newer expanded projects. And we have an environmental cooperative research program looking at mitigating or reducing or eliminating the impacts of mining on the environment. And next slide shows a little more detail of the kind of work that's done. And I guess in short, on the existing permits, it's looking at compliance, but also have a program trying to understand how the wastes behave in specific to Minnesota, and have spent a lot of years looking at things like high sulfur waste, non-ferrous mining, how to mitigate, how to control the impacts that those kinds of mines might represent. Also have been very active in environmental review and permitting, and most recently ArcelorMittal expanded and added a new pit. Minnesota Steel received went through environmental review and received permits so that they can operate. They're now called ESSER Global, and we're in the middle of environmental review for a major expansion at Keewatin Taconite. They're going to add about 50% to their capacity. We're still working on the PolyMet permit and environmental review, and those continue on.
Senator Saxog.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Vegas, if I really, I don't want to waste a lot of your time here, but you know, as we look back over the last 60, 70 years in iron mining, I realize that unlike sulfur mining, it's relatively inert and all that, but would we have done anything any different in reclamation starting out than we do now had we decided that we could have? In other words, would there be as many mine dumps around, or would there be as many abandoned pits or that type of thing?
Mr. Vadas?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Saxog, the permit to mine requirements have only been in place since 1980. And so the majority of the iron mining on the range was done without the benefit of a permit. So there were no stockpiling regulations, no sloping, no vegetation, didn't have to shape pit edges. And so it was more strictly driven by the economics of mining. Had these rules been in place through time, the place would look much different than it does today. There would be sloped and vegetated stockpiles. So you can see kind of a dramatic difference between mining done before 1980 and mining done after 1980.
Okay.
I don't know if that answers your
question.
Yeah,
it really does. Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, we're not dumping tailings in Lake Superior either. Senator Chavrin.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Do you have, can you give us information on when you think the EIS for PolyMet will be completed?
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, kind of the status of that is we have received a preliminary draft EIS from our contractor, and that is being reviewed by DNR, by the Corps of Engineers, by many tribes are interested in reviewing that. And so what the next step would be to have a public draft EIS. And I really can't give you a date because I don't know. I know work continues every day on advancing that project forward. And I will tell you, it's a very complicated project, and frankly, it's the first of its kind here in the state. And there's a real interest in doing a quality job on that. But I really can't give you a date on when that would be done because I don't know.
Just follow up, Madam Chair.
Senator Shadby.
Well, I appreciate that, and I think it's important that, especially for a new endeavor, all the work be thorough. Is there anything in the rules that give you a date by which you have to finish the agency comment portion of the draft?
Madam Chair, there are dates in the rules, but they more relate to public comment period lengths and so forth. There are no dates in there as far as timeliness of getting through this process that we're in at the moment.
Okay.
In theory, I believe the EQB rules talk about 280 days, you know, six or 9 months of making it through the whole process, and I think this particular one has been going on for about 3.5 years.
Thank you.
And the, you know, the proposer has to pay for the EIS costs, generally speaking, right? But how much DNR staff time is not compensated by the proposer?
Madam Chair, that's correct. The company does need to pay for the cost of the EIS, and I think you'll see a little later on a change level, a governor's recommendation to be compensated for the time that state agencies spend on permitting for those operations as well.
So that's for permitting as well. I thought it was just for reclamation. So, okay, we'll get to that.
All right. And just quickly on this slide, I think maybe we've covered most all of this, but just to kind of give you a sense of the level of activity, there's about between 200 and 700 acres, depending on the year, of land that's disturbed by new mining. And there is about an equal amount that's permanently reclaimed. And so as new operations open new land for mining, there's some existing land that's being permanently reclaimed. And so it's a progressive, you don't wait till the end to do the reclamation. That's done as the operation goes forward. And there are things like tailings basins where they need to be stabilized for dust control. So that means vegetation needs to be established and so forth. And that's about 4,000 acres a year. So the tailings basin is still active, but in order to take care of dust issues, that kind of thing needs to be done. And so since 1980, there's been about 15,000 acres of land that's been permanently reclaimed. Next objective then is real estate, and again, managing real estate transactions on about 5.5 million acres of state-owned land. And the kinds of programs are fee and easement acquisition, land exchanges, land sales, land surveying, appraisals, doing things like leases and utility licenses and road easements, looking at generating trust fund revenue, and also county aggregate mapping. And I have a slide a little later up to talk about that. Some performance measures, and this is for fiscal 07 and 08. Acquired a little over 72,000 acres of fee and easement interest, spending about $56 million. And that is for things like forest conservation easements and wildlife management areas, water access sites, trails, state parks. So each of those programs has an acquisition plan laying out what their priorities are for their particular program. And so then Lands and Minerals then is the group that actually goes out and does the acquisition from private landowners or from other government agencies or whoever. And so that's what we've done in the last couple of years. Sold about 1,000 acres for just under $2 million. We've exchanged about 5,500 acres for about 11,000 acres, and a value of that is around $9 million. And a big part of that was exchanging school trust lands out of state parks that we accomplished during that period of time. So now there is no land left in state parks, no school trust land that can't generate revenue. And managed about 2.5 million acres of school trust land, things like timber sales and so forth. Issued utility licenses and road easements. And the revenue on those kinds of things were about $3 million. And surveyed, paid taxes, defended the state's title in court, and a number of those kinds of activities. So that, in a nutshell, is the real estate activity. And I mentioned this county aggregate mapping. There was a state statute that was passed, I think, in 86 that directed DNR to work with counties to map aggregate in their county for the purpose of the county recognizing the aggregate and the zoning decisions that they make, trying to keep aggregate available for public and private purposes in the future. And so this map just shows the counties that have been mapped, those that are in progress, they're in blue here, and those that are requested. And we will only map these counties if there's a request from the county board for this work, because there are many counties and there's only a few people working on this. So only if the county is interested in this information so that they can take this into account for their planning, those are the ones that we're interested in working with. And so this has been the performance to date on that program. As you know, in the Twin Cities area, there's millions and millions of yards of aggregate, but almost all of it is under housing developments and shopping centers, so it really can't be used. And so the purpose of that program is just trying to identify those aggregate resources so they can be available for use. Last objective is land records. And you may remember that this is a project that was funded starting last biennium. It's a two-biennium project, and it's to bring the DNR's land records up to speed so they can be used by the public. There'll be access to the public of the land records, things like being able to respond to legislative reporting requirements like PILT, and also looking at DNR being able to better manage the land that they have by understanding where it is and what the relationship is and what the restrictions are on that land. So in the end is we hope to have an integrated and accessible information package on the land holdings of the state. We're in the middle of that process, and things are going on schedule and on time and on budget. This will sort of bring DNR up to modern times as far as the standard of being able to use the kind of technology like GIS and that sort of thing that's out there for our land base. The change items.
Madam Chair, just before we get into that, members do have several fact sheets at their desk. It might be helpful if we walk through the actual fact sheet with you. It's this first one is titled 2010-2011 Biennial Budget Fact Sheet General Fund Reduction, which does contain lands and minerals, fish and wildlife, and the Division of Waters General Fund Reduction. So as we talk about this, I think Director Vadas will talk about the slide, but go through more detail on the actual change item listed on the fact sheet, which will provide clarification for members on what the actual charges will be. Thank you.
Madam Chair, then moving on, the governor's budget contains a general fund reduction for lands and minerals totaling $1.877 million. And there are two change items then to go along with that. The first is generating revenue of $1.202 million. With the intention of fully recovering the cost of mine land reclamation for the permit to mine that exists for ferrous, non-ferrous, and for peat. Also looking at recovering the cost of applications for newer amended permits. So that would be similar to what's done with environmental review now, where the company pays for the environmental review. They would also pay for the staff time looking at a newer amended permit. And the proposal also contains a fee paid by fee owners, people that own the taconite and get paid for the taconite that's mined in Minnesota. And so in the change item, there are some numbers listed there on what that would mean to various taconite operators and peat operators, and also the mineral fee owners. And I guess on this one, I'll just mention that we have been working with representatives from the iron mining industry, and they have some other ideas on how this might be funded. And so we're working with them, trying to be open and trying to understand what they're suggesting. So I guess I would call this, this is the governor's recommendation, but perhaps it could be viewed as a work in progress on trying to work through this with those entities.
Mr. Vadas, how did you come up with that 1.202 number for the costs that you would, is that supposed to reflect how much you'd bring in exactly in fees, or is that beyond what your revenue would be?
Madam Chair, that isn't intended to represent the amount, the total amount that we spend in lands and minerals on mine land reclamation. And that would be for existing permits, but also for writing new permits for new operations or transferring permits. So that's sort of the total cost to the state of this activity. And the change item then would recover that total cost in another way. So there'd be a general fund reduction and elimination, but then funding raised through fees as laid out in this change item to various entities.
So you're not cutting anything, any service, but does that represent how much you've spent in the last couple of years?
Madam Chair, that's actually more than we've spent in the last couple of years, because this number also includes people that frankly have been hired to work on these many new mining proposals that are on the table now. Historically, the amount that's been spent has been closer to $1 million a year, and so this reflects that there's an additional effort going on with that new permitting.
So you think this will cover the costs of all this new mining activity that we're anticipating after the drilling? I mean, I assume there'll be more permit applications coming.
Madam Chair, the answer is yes, with the caveat that built into this is the ability to charge for the time for those
cost.
New permits. So if there are more that come along, then there'd be more billing, because we'd have more of an effort going.
Do you know how to break down where the fees would fall? Would they mostly be for the new permits, or would most of it come in for the annual fees?
Madam Chair, there is some detail in this change item that I believe that you have. But in short, how this is set up in the change item is about 40% would be funded by existing permit holders. About 40% would be funded through a charge to fee owners, people that own the ore. And about 20% would come from billing for newer expanded permits.
Thanks. Any other questions?
The next change item, if there aren't any more questions on that one, would be a land management account. It would be a real estate reduction, and there would be a general fund reduction of $675,000. And then along with that, there would be expanded authority to charge for certain kinds of real estate transactions. And so, as it's laid out here, the increase in application fee for those kinds of transactions, like utility licenses and road easements, are estimated to generate about $612,000 if you look at historic numbers of those kinds of transactions. And so the proposal is a general fund reduction, and then increase in fees to cover the cost of individuals asking for those kinds of transactions across state land. So in other words, in the past, the general fund has supported that activity, and this proposal would change that to those groups that are asking for those things. They would pay the cost of issuing them.
Madam Chair, just on those two notes briefly. Last session, the DNR was directed to identify areas where we are doing activities funded by the general fund that are the report language that we did for mining talked about where we're doing general fund work that benefits or, in some people's terms, subsidizes industry that's out there. In building this budget, especially with the Lands and Minerals Division, we took the intention of that report that you should have received and looked at a hybrid recommendation on the mine land reclamation side of that to fund our activities, but also on our land management areas where previously someone would pay a permit, one permit fee to cover many, many land crossings, for example, on the utility side of it. We're looking at areas where so people can pay the true cost of the activities that they're actually requesting from the department. You'll see that in this and other areas of the budget, but that's the backbone of these recommendations for the Lands and Minerals Division.
And Madam Chair, if I might go back to that reclamation management fee, in the current biennium, there is a in the current fiscal year, last session there was a charge to taconite permit holders in aggregate of $200,000. And so that's in place now where current permit holders in total are paying $200,000. But the bill also went on to require that DNR report back on the full cost recovery of all reclamation activities. And so what we're seeing here is a reflection of that direction by the legislature last time to come back with a proposal to fund all those activities. And DNR did complete a report that was sent in January 15th as directed by the legislature on options for how that could be recovered. And so that report is available, and this is the outcome in the governor's recommendation.
Madam Chair, in summary, and this is historically the way we presented this information to the committee in the past biennium, so if this does not meet your needs, let me know and we can provide you more detail. We're looking at current spending levels across all funds and then breaking it out by general funds and other funds. Minerals management, $444,000 general fund, and other funds, as we had discussed, $5,792,000. My land reclamation, we're identifying those new costs there and the 2.8 other funds. Real estate management, you can see there is a the total there is $10.182 million. And then the lands record system, we're asking for a continued appropriation from existing DNR funds, non-general funds, to continue the work on that program.
So on this chart, the numbers, okay, the general fund numbers, the first question is, how did you determine that those could not be recovered through fees? And then on the column for the other funds, is that all new fees? Or no, that's more than what you're proposing for fee collection. What are the – just tell us brief what those other funds are.
Madam Chair, the other funds would be, for example, the mineral management account, the revenues that we are receiving off of those permanent school funds that the legislature – established to fund our mineral management activities. It would be the mine land reclamation fees that are in the budget that would be deposited in the natural resources fund, and those real estate management costs that would be deposited in I believe it's going to be a land access. It's going to be an account within a natural resources fund that would be established from those revenues that would be there.
Madam Chair, for real estate, the other funds, the source is this fee that's being talked about in the change level, some game and fish fund. There's a small amount of trust fund money in there for enhancing real estate management, and there's a small amount of water rec account money for especially work on water access sites.
So all the general fund dollars there, are those represent the reductions that you've mentioned, the $1.877 million per year reduction from the general fund?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
So how did you separate out that, you know, $6.5 million that you cannot charge back to anybody? Why are those continuing to be state taxpayer expenses?
Madam Chair, the kinds of activities that are represented by that, it's about $3 million a year. It's to support things like some surveying of state-owned land, so you can tell where the boundaries are, and that would be land where It would be like school trust land or non-game and fish fund type land, so it's difficult to find a place to put a charge against that. It would be things like for some of our regional real estate activities where we work with the regional management team on land asset planning and work with counties and that sort of thing. And so it's the kind of thing where it's difficult to figure out if you were to put a fee, where that fee would be charged.
Because last year, in the budget last year, we required school trust fund management to be come out of that account. And I know that was a difficult decision, but that was necessary because of our budget problems. And so why is there school trust fund management activity coming out of the general fund?
Madam Chair, I think the change that was made last time was related to mineral management. And so amounts of money for that management are paid from royalty income from the minerals. This, what we're looking at here is the surface estate. So it's work related to surface activities like what I mentioned, the leases, licenses, easements, that sort of thing.
Okay, so those are general fund. Okay. Members, I guess I'm just going to ask members to just look at these numbers in general, especially when we're looking at general fund, because that's our big challenge is the general fund and how to balance the general fund budget. If you want to get a more detailed breakdown of how that money is spent, we can certainly ask for a detailed budget if that would be helpful. Yeah, we should talk about PILT as well. And is that part of your presentation, or should we bring up?
Madam Chair, I do have a handout. If you want to talk about the actual PILT appropriations,
yep,
historical, and what PILT is, I just need to get that. And I'll be bringing up Paul Polgar to help talk about those issues.
Do you have his name? Don has it.
Madam Chair, what we're distributing today is actually two spreadsheets and then just a one-page document that outlines what PILT is. And maybe I'll just have Mr. Pojar from our Lands and Minerals Division describe actually the narrative as that's going around talking about PILT. It's the title is PILT Payments to Counties, a Primer. It really is a complex issue that we appreciate the time discussing with you. So with that, we have Mr. Pojar walk through just a two-minute synopsis of what PILT payments are, and we can talk about the numbers after that, Madam Chair.
Okay. Do you want to? Yeah, I have it. Do you want to maybe move over a little so everyone can see you?
Yeah.
Thank you. And you need to use the microphone. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Paul Pojar. I work for the Department of Natural Resources, Lands and Minerals, and one of the tasks I work on is payment in lieu of taxes, more commonly called PILT. PILT was originally put together in about 1980 and now has become a local government aid type of a payment to help the counties to help the DNR administer land or to provide services that the we need in order to do our job take care of the natural resources out there. It's a very complex kind of a series of formulas that are used to determine what each county is entitled to be paid. There are various different types of land, and each different type has a different payment. I put together this primer, and it breaks down the types of land into what is known as acquired natural resource land. These are pretty much lands that we have gone out and purchased, and when we purchased them, they were on the tax rolls. So we bought them from a private person who was paying taxes. When we purchased the land, we no longer pay taxes and instead pay an in-lieu payment. That's one type. There's another type of land out there, DNR managed other lands. These are not acquired. These were lands that came to us primarily from the federal government. These are trust fund lands that were provided to us from the federal government, and they have a different payment level on them. The third type of lands are county-managed other natural resource lands, and these are basically tax-forfeited lands. The state holds title to these lands when the lands go forfeited. We hold them for the local units of government that were receiving taxes until they were forfeited. And so that receives yet a different amount of payment. So that takes care of the primer. You have another handout that gives sort of a historical perspective of what the payments have been over time. Like I said, PILT began in about 1980, and from 80 until about 1995, the payments were based on dollars per acre payments. And these payments didn't change over those 15 or 20 years. They were held constant. And so the payment in total was held constant. In 2000, it was determined by the legislature that those payments that were held for 15 years at the same rate should really be adjusted for inflation. And so in 2000, we started to see an increase in the payment from year to year, and these were due to inflation adjustments. And so beginning in 2001, for example, the payments went from about $6.5 million or so up to $11.5 million or so. Again, in 2006, there was another jump in payments. And these jumps are basically because of a change that was made in the PILT formula in 1995, which allowed certain of those lands that I described earlier to be paid not at a dollar per acre amount, but to be paid at a percentage of their estimated market value. And the estimated market value for lands has gone, it was skyrocketing in the 90s and the early 2000s, and only in the last few months has that changed around. And so because of that requirement to pay at estimated market value, the payment amounts have gone up, skyrocketed. Again, this page here shows you for the upcoming three fiscal years, 10, 11, 12, and 13, what the governor's recommendation is. It's on that last column. And the column before that column is what the formula would predict the payments to be. So for 2010, for example, the formula says, requires us to pay $21.7 million. And the governor's proposal or recommendation is to pay 80% of that amount, or $17.4 million.
That's interesting.
The last spreadsheet you have is that long one, and it breaks down every county's payments and the amount of acres of the various different types of land in that county and the payment amounts for each of those different types of land. Again, the last column of numbers is the 80% recommendation, and the column before that is the proposal based on the calculations that would be made from the formula that's currently in statute.
Thank you very much. I know it's complicated because there's so many different formulas and different statutes that apply for different types of land. And I don't know, so it's hard to generalize. But I guess my main question is, it sounds like originally the PILT payments were made to compensate for administrative and management costs of local governments. And now it's sort of evolved, at least in my understanding, to be more of a sort of just a compensation for lost tax base. Is that accurate, or is that just, or is there a requirement that this money be used for any particular purposes? Is it required to be used for land management in any of these categories?
Well, I think originally the idea was to compensate or to obviously when you have land that is being taxed and we come along and purchase it and are no longer paying a tax, somebody else has to take over that tax burden. So I think it was originally intended to reduce the tax levy to the people in the counties. And the money that goes to the counties is distributed to the counties primarily and also to the townships. And so that was the concept back then, I believe. I wasn't around when that was originally formed, so I don't know what those numbers really meant at that point in time. I think the changes that have been made over time to the formulas have changed that, whatever concept that existed, it's now been changed because of the changes that have occurred. If you're asking for a recommendation, it might be good to have a group sit down and try and figure out what they want PILT to, what they want it to pay for in the future.
And I agree, it may be time to just have that conversation in more detail at some point, but are some of the payments required to be used for land management purposes now? I guess that's, do you want to talk about, Mr. Pohar? Ojar?
Yes, thank you. The only management that is required within the statute is for the lands that are tax forfeited. And half of the payment that goes from the state to the county is to be used for the management of those tax-forfeited lands.
But the rest of it is pretty much state-administered land. I mean,
that's correct, yes.
Most of it is DNR, except for the tax forfeit. Maybe I'm generalizing too much, but most of it is DNR-managed land.
That's correct, and that's been... management has been provided by through general fund appropriations over time.
So the governor's proposing a permanent, it looks like it's into the future, biennia of reduction to 80%, not just for this biennium.
I haven't seen the language yet. I'm anticipating that that's correct. There's a beginning date, but no end date stated.
I think somebody needs to, and I've talked about this before in the Heritage Council, there's a lot of discussion about how much new land could be acquired over the next 25 years of the constitutional amendment. Somebody needs to sit down and estimate how much PILT impact that could have and think about whether this is sustainable into the future. Anyway, it's just a conversation we're going to have as we go through budget problems.
On the impact side, I think it'd be easy enough to just add 3/4 of 1% of appraised value to every acquisition, and amortize that into the future. That's basically what we're doing. We can help you generate any type of data that you need. Just let us know.
Yeah, but if it's coming from two separate budgets, I don't know if we're going to put that expenditure on into the legacy funds or not. That's something we need to talk about. Senator Dill?
Well, Madam Chair, I would like to have one of the witnesses tell me how closely these payments come to the payment that would be paid on the land if it was privately owned.
Mr. Pogiar?
Madam Chairman, Senator, that's kind of difficult. We have 87 different counties represented here with these numbers, and each county is a little bit different. The northern counties are different than the southern counties. Taxes that are paid on by an individual who owns land in the Twin Cities area are substantially different than the taxes that an individual owning land in the northern counties pay. You almost have to look at each county individually, or at least break it down into regions of the state to answer your question.
Madam Chair, Senator Dill, I spoke with one landowner recently when we were talking about this, who's a member of the legislature, who owns some land and is tasked as seasonal rack land. And we did the back of the envelope calculation based upon 0.75% of the appraised value of what he pays now. And for that property and where it's located, it was pretty close to what he pays in taxes. But again, as Mr. Pogiar stated, that all depends on the tax classification rate and the location and what those counties are assessing to those landowners.
We're just, if you look at this spreadsheet, we're noting the growth is pretty remarkable here, that from 2005, total pill payments were $13 million, and by 2012, they're expected to be $26 million. That's doubling in 7 years. As Mr. Mueller was saying, it looks like the Health and Human Services budget. At least it's not as big a portion of, I mean, it's a small, little tiny piece of the budget in comparison, but it is on a trajectory of high growth that doesn't account for more acquisition. Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, there's, as you pointed out in the beginning, it seems like things switch back and forth, but that some of that additional value is value. I mean, what land is worth?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely true.
And so that affects
the money, some of it, yeah. The cost quite a bit. And I've talked about, on the one hand, the equity issue for some, you know, I always have to mention my city that I represent, that 66% tax-exempt land that doesn't, as far as I know, doesn't get any PILT money because it's not, you know, an SNA. It's not natural resource land. It's other types of tax-exempt land. So that was a decision made a long time ago. And on the other hand, there's no doubt that these units of government, especially in the era of LGA cuts, rely on these.
Absolutely.
as state aid payments for their budgets. And so it needs to be a discussion that takes that whole big picture into account. But anyway, it's on the table now for us to look at. So that's helpful. Any other questions on this issue? All right, great. Well, let's move on. Thank you very much.
Chair members. Next, we'll move on to the Division of Fish and Wildlife with bringing up Director David Shad. And again, Madam Chair, we are going to go over some of these performance objectives and things rather quickly to focus our time on the change items at hand.
Okay, welcome to the committee.
An outline briefly on the Fish and Wildlife presentation here, budget and critical trends, talking about strategic objectives, and then the outcomes, measures, and how our change items relate to those changes or outcomes and measures. Madam Chair, you can see the core function of the Fish and Wildlife Division is to conserve and restore fish and wildlife populations and habitats and support natural resource-based recreation. It's pretty straightforward. Protect and restore fish and wildlife habitat. Working to make sure that we know, conducting fish and wildlife inventories, research and monitoring, technical assistance and education piece is very important to the public. And managing these populations through both big game, small game, waterfowl, migratory bird, and fur bear species through regulated harvest. Just briefly, a couple comments about the questions or customers that we serve. 1.4 million licensed anglers. There's an additional 600,000 anglers, youth primarily, that are not required to be licensed. 1,700 commercial fishery operations and over 2,000 resort and tourist businesses. Almost 600,000 licensed hunters and trappers. 2.1 million wildlife watchers and viewers. 54% participation rate, which is the second highest in the nation. And the fishing, hunting, and wildlife watching and trapping generate $3.5 billion in annual expenditures in the state of Minnesota. Just want to spend a brief second on the 08-09 budget for the Fish and Wildlife Division. Approximately $180.9 million, with 74% coming from the Game and Fish Fund. The other funding sources, the Environmental Trust Fund is $2.1 million, the gift account, $500,000, the RIM Reinvested Minnesota account is $7 million, treaty payments, which come from the general fund at $15.8 million. There was $6.6 million in general fund, $5.7 million in natural resources fund, $5.6 million in federal, and $3 million in the special revenue fund. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Director Shad to talk a little bit about the outdoor trends, recreation participation issues we're facing, and then get into the change items, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, Dave Shad, Fish and Wildlife Director for Department of Natural Resources. Wanted to just highlight three trends that are affecting our work and some of the priorities that are reflected in the budget that we're presenting to you today. The first critical trend is related to outdoor recreation, and I think you heard some of this from Parks and Trails last week, I believe, but we're seeing some of the same kinds of trends related to youth and related to participation in the outdoors. As it relates to fishing and hunting activities, the graph here shows the rate of participation, and you can see that most of those bars are below that heavy dark line, which indicates that people are participating at a lower rate in both fishing and hunting activities in almost all age classes. We saw significant declines just in 5 years from 2000 to 2005, and we're also seeing some declines in real numbers, especially among younger age classes in both hunting and angling. Second trend that I wanted to highlight, and that is habitat loss and fragmentation. This has been an ongoing challenge and an ongoing priority for our division over the years. We attempt to strategically conserve the highest priority fish and wildlife lands that remain out there, and then also restore those lands if they are in a degraded condition. The third trend that I wanted to highlight is climate change and a closely related trend, and that has to do with energy, changes in energy in the state. Climate change, as the models predict, could have profound impacts on fish and wildlife and on use of fish and wildlife and recreation here in the state. We're just in the very early stages of kind of getting our arms around that, getting a better understanding of what some of these models might mean to fish and wildlife here in this state, and also how some of the changes in energy, especially related to biofuels and that sort of thing, how those might impact fish and wildlife habitats, both in a positive and a negative way. We've got five strategic objectives steer the work of the division, and I'd like to just talk a little bit about each of those objectives. First is managing fish and wildlife populations and recreation, especially hunting and angling recreation that's associated with those populations. You can see some of the programs associated with this objective. They include some of the monitoring programs. We need to track status of populations out there. We conduct research to improve our ability to manage populations out there. Of course, we do fish stocking. One of the real emerging issues here related to this strategic objective is fish and wildlife disease management. Just 5 years ago, we didn't have a disease program in our division. Now we've got a very robust program. We're spending a lot of time, a lot of energy, and a lot of dollars on things like bovine TB in the northwestern part of the state, monitoring for chronic wasting disease, monitoring and preparing for VHS here in the state and so on. And so this has become a real growth area for our programs and one that we're spending more and more time and attention on. As an example, an outcome here would be related to the improvement of the Red Lake fishery. As you know, that population crashed back in the mid-1990s. Through stocking, through pretty intensive survey work, through development of regulations, coordination work with the Red Lake Band, we were able to successfully recover that lake and are now able to provide some very good and very high-quality angling opportunities and all the economic benefits that come with that fishery being reopened. A second outcome related to this objective has to do with pheasant harvest. And this is really an indicator of the health of our fish and wildlife habitat out in agricultural areas of the state. You can see in this graph that we had very high pheasant harvest back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and into the early 60s. These are commonly referred to as the soil bank days. A lot of that soil bank, a lot of that set-aside land, disappeared in the 1970s. You can see the drop in pheasant populations. And now in recent years, we've seen some recovery of that. In fact, we had as a goal to achieve a pheasant harvest of 450,000 pheasants by the year 2008. We actually exceeded that goal. We're shooting in excess of 500,000 birds a year right now, and that's due in large part to the amount of grass that's out in the landscape as a result of the Conservation Reserve Program and many other programs associated with the Farm Bill. So it's an indication of what happens on private lands really drives populations out in that part of the state.
So how long will it take to get to 3 million pheasants?
As far as the population goes?
Well, that's what you said your goal is, yeah.
Yeah. We've got a ways to go. We've got both a harvest goal and a population goal. And if we hit that 3 million population, we would also achieve that harvest objective of 750,000 pheasants. And that's going to require a long period of time. We'd need a lot more grass on the landscape than we've got now. Moving on to change items associated with this objective, there are three. The first is to provide some base-level funding for implementation of our wolf management plan. And there's two aspects to this funding initiative. The first is to establish a population monitoring program so we can monitor the status of that population going into the future. We'd like to conduct a two-year pilot to develop a new survey method. Wolves are difficult to survey and very expensive to survey, and we've got plans to develop an alternative survey approach and then to maintain that survey over time so we can track that population and impacts things like disease and that sort of thing might have on that population. The second aspect of this initiative is to provide a state match or a state contribution to the wolf livestock depredation program that is now currently exclusively funded by the federal government through USDA APHIS Wildlife Services. And so this would provide the funding we need to come up with the state share of that. The federal government would still contribute funding and the federal employees would continue to do the actual control work out there of wolves, but the state would be contributing funding to assist with that program. And it's been a very, very successful program and actually has helped maintain support for wolf recovery by landowners in the wolf range.
Madam Chair.
So, Senator Paraso.
Madam Chair, Mr. Shad, do you also monitor coyote populations and where they're ranging and growing in numbers?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Paraso.
And the effect they have on bird populations?
You know, we don't have a real precise survey of coyotes. We have some surveys that can track trends generally. For example, we do a track count in the fall that picks up coyotes, and so we can get an idea of range expansion and just a general idea of trends and numbers. We also track harvest, of course, through fur buyers and surveys of trappers and that sort of thing. So we've got pretty good indicators of the health of the coyote population, and certainly we've seen an expansion of that, the range of coyotes over time. They're now in just about every corner of the state.
Okay. So on wolf populations, are you seeing more, you know, what's the population trends and how much depredation are you seeing? Thank you.
Madam Chair, actually, our wolf population has been pretty stable for the last 5 to 10 years. We believe that basically we've got a saturated wolf population, all available habitat in pretty much the northern third of the state contains about as many wolves as we can fit in that part of the state. And based on that stable population, the number of complaints by livestock owners has been fairly stable also, as has the number of wolves being taken by the federal trappers.
Okay, so the money for the depredation, it's not because there's a need that wasn't there before. It's that you have to match federal dollars?
Yeah, Madam Chair, in the past that program's been exclusively funded by the federal government, and that's partly as a result of the fact that they're a federally protected animal under the Endangered Species Act. That funding is now drying up, USDA funding for that purpose, and so we're being asked, the state's being asked to contribute a share of that. Once and hopefully eventually when the wolf is delisted and comes back under state management, we would have to assume that cost anyway.
Okay. And then the study and research, that's a new endeavor that you're proposing.
Yeah, Madam Chair, that is actually a part of our wolf management plan that we developed. And we've agreed to monitor wolf populations like we do other wildlife populations on a more regular basis. Typically, as wolves have been under federal control, we've done a survey every 5 to 10 years, but once the wolf is turned over to the state for management, we see the need to do a more regular survey, and this funding would provide the means to develop that approach, that survey approach, and to conduct that survey over time.
So where does the money coming from exactly for this?
Madam Chair, this would be from the non-game account within the Natural Resources Fund.
And that's all from the Chickadee Checkoff? Or where is that, where it gets all its money?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay, and does this fit the purposes of that checkoff as it's, you know, advertised to the voters?
Madam Chair, it's a non-hunted, non-trapped animal. There are provisions in the wolf management plan and in statute that would allow wolves to be trapped or hunted 5 years after they're removed from the endangered species list. That hasn't happened yet, so that 5-year clock hasn't started to tick yet. But at this time, even if the federal government removed protection from wolves, they would be considered a non-game species here in the state.
Well, I think the monitoring and research would be a good fit. I'm not sure about the depredation, whether that really fits the purposes. I mean, the Chickadee Checkoff, that fund is meant for protecting and promoting wildlife.
Sure. And Madam Chair, just I know that's been a very important program in helping maintain support for what we've got are very high wolf populations up in that part of the state where wolves and livestock operations coexist up there, and so it has resulted in additional support for, you know, fairly high populations of wolves across much of the state. So.
Yeah, and it's important that we have that available, but for compensation, but I'm not sure if this is the right place to take the money from. Okay.
Madam Chair, members, I know you were looking at our fact sheet, Madam Chair. I just want to bring the members' attention. You will have in front of you for each of our change items a fact sheet with the title on it, with the capital picture on the front of it. Just that does contain more detail than our slides do. So if you have any questions or for future information, we three-hole punch those so you can put them right in your book. So moving on to the next change item then.
Yeah, Madam Chair, committee members, our second change item is a general fund change item. It would provide $600,000 per year in each of the 2 years in one-time dollars to fund DNR's part of managing the TB outbreak in northwestern Minnesota. We've been working very closely with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture and the Board of Animal Health to really aggressively go after this TB outbreak that's occurred in both cattle and deer up in the Marshall County area. To date, we've tested some 5,500 deer through very aggressive testing of hunter-harvested deer. We've also conducted sharpshooting and aerial gunning programs to reduce deer populations in the TB area and test additional deer. The good news is that this year so far, we've not found any TB-positive deer. We've had 24 deer in total since we started testing that have been found to have bovine tuberculosis, but this year we found none. I think that's an indication that our very aggressive approach here has been working, and we need to keep the pressure on. We need to stay aggressive. And so this initiative, this change item, would provide the funding we need for the testing, for the surveillance, and for the deer removal over the next 2 years.
Any questions?
The third and final change item under this objective would provide us an appropriation from the new walleye stamp that was approved by the legislature last year. We're asking here for an appropriation of $285,000 per year in each year. This would represent the amount of money that would be going into that account if 5% of our licensed anglers bought this stamp. We're not sure what the interest might be. We are doing some marketing, and for example, the back cover of our hunting or our fishing regulations booklet will advertise the availability of that stamp this year, and we're going to do what we can to try to encourage folks to buy that stamp, and this change level would allow us to access those dollars right away in the next biennium.
Madam Chair, this proposal, we're going to start trying to get a statutory appropriation on this, so we'll actually be able to use the dollars that are in the account to be appropriated rather than having the account build up a balance and having us to come back and access that balance on a biennial budget cycle. We'd just like to have the ability to take the dollars that are put into that account on each year and use them for walleye stocking the following spring. So we'll talk more about that as we actually move forward with the language.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Chaudhry.
Mr. Shad, how will you pay for stocking if you don't sell that many stamps?
Senator Chaudhry, our intent would be to continue to fund stocking programs as we have in the past, and we've got targets established about 160,000 pounds altogether for fingerling stocking, and we have identified funds each of the next 2 years to do that funding. The funding that we would receive as a result of this stamp would allow us to accelerate that stocking and actually shift some of that production to the private growers, to the private sector. So we would intend to use these dollars raised by this stamp to actually purchase additional fish from the private sector.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Chaudhry.
I thought I heard that the from that your answer was that the intent is to continue the current level of funding and then add this on top of the current level of funding. Is it in the department's budget for the next biennium to continue the previous level of stocking funding and then use this on top of that? Is that part of the department's budget for this biennium?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, that's correct. We're not proposing any cuts in our walleye stocking program.
Thank you.
And Mr. Shad, do you how much of stocking is done now with private
Mr. contractors? Chairman, as I mentioned, we currently stock about 160,000 pounds of fingerlings. Of that 160,000 pounds, 40,000 pounds are purchased from the private sector, and 120,000 are raised in DNR ponds.
Moving on, Mr. Chair, members, strategic objective number two.
This second objective relates to restoring habitat and providing access. It involves activities related to land acquisition, lake restoration, monitoring habitat conditions out in the state, and we also do field work associated with the department's aquatic plant management program. One indicator related to this objective would be acres protected within wildlife management areas. Minnesota actually has one of the largest wildlife management area systems in the country. It encompasses about 1.2 million acres at this time in all 87 counties. As you can see, since the year 2000, about 50,000 acres have been added to that system. And these wildlife management areas, they not only protect habitat and in many cases rare resources. For example, much of the native prairie that remains in the state exists on wildlife management areas, but they also are very important in providing hunting opportunity in many areas of the state. And what we've found and other states have found are that public lands are really key to addressing some of these recreation trends that we're seeing related to hunting participation. We've got just one change level related to this objective. It would provide $950,000 to the division in the second year, in 2011, from the Clean Water Fund to provide funding for fishery staff to help implement the Clean Water Legacy Program. Our fisheries folks have some unique expertise that they can bring to bear in assisting with surveys to identify impaired waters, to assess fish populations as indicators of lake health, and something we call the Index of Biotic Integrity, and also to assist in development of watershed plans to address impaired waters and improve those waters.
Madam Chair, members, these would be new activities for the Division of Fish and Wildlife. So this, the activities they would undertake for Clean Water Legacy in FY11 are not being taken. We are not doing this work right now. So this would be completely new activities related to the Clean Water Legacy Fund.
Well, who's doing it now?
Madam Chair, this work is not getting done. This would be new work that would be done to help meet the goals.
But somebody in your agency is doing... Some of this is doing assessments of impaired waters with the clean water money we gave you before. So what's different about this?
Madam Chair, we can discuss some of that with Ecological Resources on Thursday, that they're doing some of these activities, but this is well above and beyond what we've been funded for in the past, and it would help us to reach those goals that people have established on assessing and completing PNDL studies on a 10-year cycle, I believe.
Madam Chair, the fisheries expertise hasn't really been brought to bear to a great extent in the whole impaired waters process, the clean waters process. Fish populations are very, very good indicators of not only the health of individual waters, but the health of watersheds. And so in working with the other divisions in DNR that have been more directly involved, and PCA and Bowser, this need to get fisheries expertise to the table, both as we assess impaired waters and as we develop remediation plans, as has been identified as a need.
So what will fisheries do that's different from what ECOS, whatever it's called now, ECOS Services, does in their assessments?
Madam Chair, just one example. For some of the surveys that are done to identify impaired waters right now, the agencies that are conducting those assessments are using whatever fisheries data might be available out there, and it might be very recent, or it might be 10 or 15 or 20 years old, and that's made it more difficult to do those assessments. This would provide that very important fisheries data as part of those assessments and allow a better and more complete assessment of where those impairments occur and exactly what the impairments are.
But you would still be assessing for other conventional impairments too, right?
Madam Chair, that's correct. We'd be adding fisheries population data to the mix here. Basically.
So that part is really valuable and important. I'm glad you're thinking about that. But on the other hand, moving the general assessments from one division to another, that doesn't I'm not sure that meets the voters' intent for additional funding for the legacy. So we really need to get a better sense of how this is above and beyond what we've already been doing.
Madam Chair, we hope to have that opportunity within Senator Rummel's committee with all of the environment agencies together to talk about how the governor's proposal really looks at all the activities and how they fit together in a complete process. So hopefully we can have that discussion soon.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Your item number 2, expand field crews in Lake Index of Biotic Integrity. So what are they doing now, and how will you expand them?
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, my understanding is that we're not meeting this goal of 100 lakes per year, and a very important element of developing this index is assessment of fish populations. This has been identified as a need related to identification and management of impaired waters, using fisheries populations as an indicator of lake health. And this would allow us to, and we have developed those indexes, we've developed this technique. This would allow us to actually go out on these 100 lakes and start to collect the data and determine whether or not, based on fish populations, whether or not we're actually successful in addressing some of the impairments.
It's gonna take the bus home. Okay.
Moving on to our third strategic objective, that relates to providing technical assistance, planning, and public participation in the work that we do. This work involves engaging private landowners, other land managers, county land managers, other forest managers, and communities to help us achieve fish and wildlife objectives. And you can see some of the activities associated with this objective. Wanted to give one example of an outcome related to this example or this objective, and it relates to our duck recovery plan that calls for adding 2 million acres of grassland and wetland out in the prairie pothole region of the state, western and southern Minnesota, over the next 50 years. That sounds like a very ambitious objective. It equates to about 40,000 acres per year over that 50-year time frame, and you can see by this graph, in both 2006 and 2007, that we actually met or exceeded that 40,000-acre target. And you can see the contributions that Wildlife Management Area acquisition, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service acquisition, and farm programs on private lands made towards that 40,000-acre objective. And you, obviously, farm programs and what happens on private lands is key to meeting that. In 2008, you can see that we were not successful in meeting that objective. In fact, we lost acres, and that was due in large part to the loss of Conservation Reserve Program grasslands in the state. We lost about 90,000 acres in that year. We gained back about 30,000 of those acres in other farm programs, buffer programs, and that sort of thing. But it still resulted in a net loss of 60,000 acres of grassland habitat on private lands. And the relatively small contributions from our land acquisition programs weren't enough to offset those losses. So it points out the need for us to be engaged with private landowners and to be involved out there in what's happening on those lands in order for us to meet our fish and wildlife goals.
And to have permanent easements.
Our fourth strategic objective relates to outreach and department programs. This is basically recruitment and retention programs to encourage youth, especially, to take up hunting and angling, and also some of the environmental education and aquatic education programs that are housed in our division. One example of an activity under this objective is our very, very successful Archery in the Schools program. This program has grown in just four short years to the point where now we've got over 80,000 kids in schools all across the state picking up bows and arrows in the schools and actually taking part in this after-school program. And the schools and the participants in this program just love it. It's been a great program. At the same time, we've seen a growth in youth archery license sales, and so it appears we haven't done much survey work here to document this, but it appears that while we're getting kids involved with shooting bows and arrows, that we may also be recruiting new young archers, and this is in the face of other trends related to youth participation that are showing declines both in hunting and angling. So it's, I think, just one example of some of the good work we can do to try to address this really important trend related to outdoor recreation.
Do you know which schools around the state are participating? I mean, do you have a sort of a, give us a map of that or a guess?
Madam Chair, there are in almost every corner of the state, I think over 200 schools now. So it's been very successful and actually very well accepted. If you told me 5 years ago that we'd have that many schools that would allow bows and arrows to even come into the school, much less have kids shooting them, I would have said I doubt it. But it's been very, very well accepted.
I'm kind of wondering if we have any of them in the cities, because I'd be surprised. They, you know, you got to have a pretty big space to be able to do that, and I don't know, but I haven't heard of it in St. Paul schools, but maybe.
Madam Chair, actually, there are quite a large number in the urban areas, and you can do this in a gymnasium. They've got equipment that we provide to the schools that allow them to do this shooting very safely in very confined areas.
Great.
Our fifth objective relates to public information and customer service. A lot of this activity relates to our electronic licensing system. We process about 3.5 million transactions through that ELS system annually, selling licenses and permits and that sort of thing. This also involves public information, our staff meeting with the public, meeting with conservation organizations around the state, and getting them more involved in the work of the division.
If you'll forgive me, I just, speaking of information, is my 2008 fishing license good this weekend if I want to go ice fishing in February? Is it still good?
Madam Chair, it's actually good through the end of April.
Okay.
So,
thank you.
You're in luck.
Thank you, Senator Saxon. Yeah.
Madam Chair, moving on to the general.
We're going up north.
Moving on to the general fund reduction change item. This is discussed briefly in the general fund budget reduction fact sheet that you have in front of you. looking at the department or the Division of Fish and Wildlife's budget of $150 million approximately, Madam Chair, this 2.7 per year represents about 2.8% reduction in their budget. You can see what we've identified here is reductions, $1 million each year for the population management objective, focusing on population surveys, creel surveys, hatchery efficiencies and research, 3.5% reduction or $800,000 each fiscal year under the habitat management piece, and this would be reductions in soil water conservation districts, shoreland grants, and our informal environmental review activities that we do on a volunteer basis when we are not the responsible government unit. 4.3% or $400,010 and $400,011 reduction in technical assistance. This would be primarily in the areas of watershed planning, private lands works, and forest planning. 5.8% in outreach, $100,000 each year. This will involve the Minnesota Shooting Sports Center, volunteer programs, and a reduction in efforts in the Minocle program. And also a $400,000 reduction in public information and customer service objective, focusing on office consolidations, vacancy holdings, and a decrease in our public contact abilities, Madam Chair. This does not represent all of the general fund within the Fish and Wildlife Division. As we discussed, there is a $600,000 change item for the bovine tuberculosis activities. And looking at general fund, you have to remember that the heritage dollars or the lottery and loo dollars are a general fund source, and that's almost $10 million a year that goes into the Division of Fish and Wildlife that are tied back to the general fund. So this represents a very small, though significant, reduction in the area of fish and wildlife. It's one that, as we looked at the department as a whole, we thought we would be able to sustain.
So how much of this is being, will the work still be done by Game and Fish funds? And how much of it is actually going to reduce the work?
Madam Chair, there are some activities that have been funded by the general fund that will continue to do. But from Game and Fish Fund, an example of that would be some of the really intensive survey work that we do up in the 1837 treaty area on Mille Lacs Lake, especially. Because that lake is managed so intensively, because the harvest is shared between state and tribal fisheries, we've used general fund to do some pretty intensive work there in order to develop the data we need in order to create the models and provide the information so that we can determine safe harvest levels and manage that fishery between the tribes and the state. Obviously, we need to continue to do that. That's a very important fishery. We need to continue to collect that data, and we'll be shifting that to the Game and Fish Fund. In other cases, the general fund has been used to support just our staff that do a wide variety of things. And so with this loss in general fund, it's going to equate in fewer people out there doing the work. And that's why the public's going to see a little bit less of us. We're going to do fewer lake surveys in many cases on some of our medium-sized lakes. Instead of surveying those lakes for fishery and assessing fisheries populations on a 3 to 5 year rotation, we might shift to a 7 to 10 year rotation. So we're not going to have quite as good information available to base our management decisions on those lakes. And that's simply a reflection of fewer people out there available to do the work.
Can you, and I had asked about this when we met yesterday, we'd like to get more detailed information about what layoffs would come from these cuts so we can have good information when we make our decisions about whether to accept these recommendations. We need to know whether it's actual layoffs or whether it's attrition that will be.
Yeah, Madam Chair, we are at this time holding about 25 vacancies that we've been actively managing here for the last year and a half or so in anticipation of a tighter budget for the next biennium. And so there's those 25 vacancies, and we can provide you that information as far as additional FTEs that we expect to lose through attrition, hopefully, or possibly through layoff as a result of this proposed budget. I don't have that here today.
And I know you haven't proposed any license fee increases, but you've suggested that they're due. That what would it take in license fees to avoid some of these reductions?
Madam Chair, the last fishing and hunting license fee was in 2001, I believe. The Game and Fish Fund is still in the black at this time. At current levels of funding, it's projected to go into the red in about 2012. So we do have a little bit of time left, but we are now spending more than we're bringing in as far as the Game and Fish Fund goes. So we could develop a calculation that would project out what kind of license fee increase might be needed to bring revenues up to the level of expenditures, if that would be helpful. Or we could also provide a projection of the level of the fee increase that would be needed to offset this general fund reduction.
It would be helpful because it's, you know, we're going to have that discussion sooner or later.
Sure.
We might as well have full information now because this could, you know, well, we'll be having that discussion in 2 years if we don't have it now. So we might as well look at the long term because this is another cost that we have to decide is worthwhile or not. Senator Chaudhry.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Question on the Minocqua reduction. On page 11 of your PowerPoint, you have increase youth recreation participation, multicultural, urban, and youth, aquatic and angling education. But then you have a reduction in Minocqua, which does exactly that. Could you reconcile that, those two?
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, the Minocqua program is both an aquatic education and a angler recruitment program. We've developed a curriculum that's actually been nationally recognized for its quality. We're in the process of training teachers to actually deliver that curriculum in the classrooms. And so our focus has shifted a little bit from developing that curriculum to actually delivering that curriculum and doing teacher training and that kind of thing. So it's allowed us to look at some efficiencies and shift effort a little bit. It's not a reflection of a lower priority of the program, and actually the cuts are relatively minor. It's I think a couple of intern positions that we have been funding in the past wouldn't be funded over the next 2 years, but that program would still be a very important priority for us.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members, this last slide just shows the governor's recommendation for the Division of Fish and Wildlife at approximately $176 million, 77.1% of that coming from the general fund. You can see the other mix of funds that the governor's budget does recommend: $950,000 from the Clean Water Fund, 8.1% from special revenue, 8.2% from federal funds. General fund treaty payments, $15.2 million. It does show that $1.2 million in the general fund for the biennium for the bovine TB funding and $6.6 million for natural resources funding, Madam Chair. If there's no other questions, we can start waters, or do you want to?
Yeah, I think we should start.
This last slide, again, it just shows overall spending, current spending levels on the top line with the treaty payments on there, and then the governor's initiatives by the change item. General fund reduction, bovine TB monitoring, clean water legacy, gray wolf management and research, and then the walleye stamp appropriation and the totals that we talked about. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
We'll move into Division of Waters. Bring up Division Director Kent Lockesmo. Director Lockesmo corrected me that I did say 77 general fund, it is 77% game and fish fund, so I apologize for that. All right, moving into waters, we've talked about the budget, critical trends, strategic objectives, and then priority outcome measures. Division of waters is, as the rest of our divisions go, is a pretty small budget, and it's mostly all general fund and federal funding. If you look at it that way, it's about $36 million. This slide is a little bit off. It shows 74.7% general fund and 19.2% federal funding. Well, that federal funding number is a rolling number. It's really not, you can't look at it as a biennial number. We get federal funds appropriated to us, and they don't go biennium by biennia. So actually this number, the general fund part, is a lot larger than that 75% there. You can see $700,000 from the Natural Resources Fund, $600,000 special revenue, and $900,000 right now from the Environmental Trust Fund. I'll just have Director Lacus go talk about the populations that the division serves and their priority outcomes.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Kent Lacusmo, Director of the Division of Waters for DNR. As you can see on this first slide, our clientele are the people of Minnesota. We provide information, stewardship, education, and technical assistance to agencies, local governments, planning commissions, general public. This is technical studies, groundwater, surface water, climatology. You see our climatology information in the newspaper quite often. Then we also have grants, training, technical assistance to local governments. Local governments administer our floodplain and shoreland programs. We provide oversight to that. And then we also have permit programs for both water use and public waters protection. And water is one of, if not our most valuable resource. Everyone relies on water. It's a key economic driver for growth. People need water for many, many activities, and certainly whether it's recreation or it's use of water into products. Inadequate information provides difficulties, whether or not it's in siting plants where there's sufficient water. And what we've seen over time is that the issues relating to water management are getting much more complex. We have three major strategic objectives for the Division of Waters, and they are public waters protection, which is the land use and permits programs, water supply management, the water use programs, and then the hydrologic information for decision making, the technical information to support those other two. In strategic objective one, public waters protection, the programs are floodplains, flood mitigation, shoreland management. Like I said, that's local government administers that program. Outreach and education, there we have a Project WET, water education for teachers. Public waters permits and coastal zone management, which is a federal program. There's federal money that supports that. We run the program out of Two Harbors, and there's over 50% of the money that we get from the federal government goes back out in grants to local governments and local partners in the coast. One of the issues that we have is flood hazard mitigation, protecting communities from repetitive flood damages. This is a map of the city of Crookston. You can see the shaded areas are within the floodplain, and it's another one of those. You know, as Minnesota developed, we put communities in places that probably aren't the best places for communities, and they filled in all of these oxbows with homes. We're in the process of doing a project in Crookston. It's predominantly with bonding money, although we do have some general fund funds that go towards removing flood-prone structures from floodplains across the state. And this project would end up, ultimately, you'll protect 451 homes, and that's, you know, they're probably worth, you know, $50 million or something in that ballpark. So it's a very well-received program. The general fund reduction basically comes all from this first priority area that we have. These are annual numbers, the $640,000. The Headwaters Board grant and the Leech Lake Band grant, those are grant dollars that go through to those two boards to oversee local decisions. And this is the upper Mississippi counties in the eight counties in the upper Mississippi. Red River Mediation Agreement, that's a $70,000 reduction. That reduces their current funding of $280,000 to a level of 210,000. This, if you recall, was funded at 210,000 a year in the 06-07 biennium. Last year, or last biennium, it was raised by 100,000 to $310,000 a year. The supplemental budget reduced it by 30 down to 280. So that was a starting point going into this biennial budget process. And the recommendation here is to reduce that by 70, so it gets back to that previous funding level of 210. And the shoreland rulemaking, $500,000 a year. The our goal is to have the draft rules done by June 30th of 09, and then we will go into the formal rulemaking process with the administrative law judge. And we're in the midst of developing those rules. There we have a number of advisory groups. It's a very open process, and we're on track to meet this time frame.
So on the rulemaking, we gave $1 million. This is per year, so you had $1 million in this biennium to do the rulemaking. How will you proceed without any money in the next biennium?
Madam Chair, the heavy lifting will have been done as far as all of these advisory committees and the meetings that are done across the state. And we would use existing staff then to go through the rule process with the formal hearings. But we expect to have the statement of need and reasonableness done and an actual draft rule that's ready to go through that formal process.
By the end of this biennium.
By the end of this fiscal year.
June 30th or what?
Yes.
So, have you spent that whole million?
Madam Chair, that money wasn't appropriated separately, so we haven't tracked that. We've spent the bulk of that on this work. We ended up with we have four staff that are dedicated to this work presently.
You have four staff?
Four. Yes.
And so those staff will be eliminated?
Madam Chair, the one of the staff persons is actually works for Ecological Services, but he's doing this work, so he would go back to his previous position in Ecological Resources. The other person that's leading this program is a hydrologist that would go back to his former position as being a shoreland hydrologist, and he would still be working on this project as it moves forward. The other two, there may be one planner position that may not continue.
So I guess I'd be interested in seeing a timeline for getting this done, because it's been dragging on for a lot of years now, the whole process. And I just want to make sure we're not delaying any longer. So the rule will be ready by June, correct?
Madam Chair, we propose to have a draft rule by June.
And then the next, and
we can lay out a time frame that
okay.
that takes that forward. The next steps are setting up the formal hearings around the state with an administrative law judge.
So I guess the question is whether this cut would delay that process into next year.
And
you think you can just manage it on the same timetable that you would have done otherwise?
Madam Chair, obviously if we have less money, it would go a little slower. But we are not going to abandon the process. We intend to move forward.
Well, we might want to put some timelines into. I mean, maybe you could propose what timelines you think are doable. That would be helpful.
Madam Chair, we can do that.
Thank you. That would be great. All right. Go ahead.
The strategic objective two is our water supply management area. And this is water appropriation permit, public water supply planning, the water use reporting. You'll recall we have about 7,000 permittees in the state that pay fees. We generate about $5.1 million. That all goes to the general fund. It's not dedicated to us. Underground gas storage, that's probably a unique function that a lot of people don't know that we do. There's about 7 billion cubic feet of gas stored underground by Waterville. And because pumping that gas in displaces the water, they needed a water appropriation permit. So we do monitoring of that facility also. This slide shows a critical trend in water use. The chart on the left shows the increasing population in the line graph, and it shows the use, the public supply, in the bar graph. And it's dependent on climate, because you can see the high use in 87, 88 were drought years, and then population has increased and water use has increased along with that. The graph on the right shows the water level changes in the Mount Simon aquifer, which is the bottom aquifer, or the lower aquifer underneath the Twin Cities. The major aquifer for most use in the Twin Cities area is the Jordan Aquifer, which is less deep. The here you can see a slight decline over time, and you can also see in the bottom of this graph the top of the Mount Simon Aquifer. It's 600 feet below the ground surface. So there's still 500 feet of water or thereabouts before you get to the top of the aquifer. So we are watching this. We are adding observation wells due to LCCMR funding and bonding funding last year, so we can monitor this and determine trends so we can manage appropriately.
So does the DNR have any of your goals or outcomes that are tied to how much, what's a sustainable amount of water to use on a yearly basis or anything like that? Or a long-term goal for how to...
Well, Madam Chair, there's certainly a statutory direction that we manage water to assure sustainability. We are looking, and last year there was legislation that required conservation rate structures. We're working with communities to achieve those goals. We're also doing water supply emergency and conservation plans. All communities larger than 1,000 population have to prepare those. And we're in the second generation of reviewing those plans. So we are working with communities to assure that they look at managing water supply, not just putting another well in because they can pump more water in the summer months. Because what you do see, if you look on an annual basis of water use, there's 3 times the use in July that there is in January, and the water use in the summer is significantly higher for the various outdoor things, but certainly turf watering is one of the major ones. 2 years ago, we had added the conservation fee onto municipal use, and that was a $20 surcharge per million gallons on the use for July or June, July, and August that exceeded January's use. And that money is it goes to the general fund also. But that generated about $600,000 a year, I believe. Is that right? Yeah. Right about in that ballpark.
And did it change water use
We
at all?
Haven't been able to determine yet if that's changed any behaviors. We will be looking at that, but water is still relatively cheap in this state, and it's not like $4 gasoline yet. I mean, people tend to want to pay for their water and use water in the summer.
So this chart concerns me. I mean, it just keeps going up, and is there any end point in sight? I mean, there's nothing that we're doing that's going to change that trajectory, is there? Specifically,
well,
I mean,
Madam Chair, I think some of the actions that we've taken in the last several years can help to curb some use. And we are dealing with water supply planning with the Metropolitan Council, and we're looking at those broader objectives. We're looking at one of the things we did this last year was a water level study, a synoptic water measurement of. It was like 250 wells that you measure in a very short period of time, and we've done this about every 10 or 15 years. We should do it more often. but then to get a look at the trends. I mean, groundwater is a renewable supply also. It's not as readily apparent as surface water. And groundwater does interact with surface water systems. The Jordan Aquifer discharges to the Mississippi River. It discharges to the Minnesota River. So it's not like it's down there in a confined bowl and there's only that limited supply. As we look at observation wells, when we see a declining aquifer, we need to be taking certain steps to assure that it doesn't go too far. And we do manage towards that.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when we hear from the Met Council and other folks that we can expect another million people to be living in the metro area in the next so many years, what are we doing to anticipate the water use of those people and still have a sustainable supply in our aquifers?
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, what we're doing is undergoing the water supply planning with Met Council that we've just it's in the final stages over the last 2 years of looking at that. There are our groundwater models that have been developed. We're looking at the trends. This synoptic water measurement study that we did with the USGS is another tool that we can look at and see the trends for declining use. There are communities that are looking at conjunctive uses where they're using both surface water and groundwater. St. Paul has that type of a system where they use Mississippi River water predominantly, but they have a backup of wells.
In my community.
The city of Moorhead has done that. They use both groundwater and surface water. Mm-hmm. So there are some communities that have made very good progress towards being able to manage that. One of the problems is that communities like City of Ramsey, while they might like to go to surface water, it's very expensive to build a surface treatment plant, and you need to have more regional systems if you're going to make that work. Because we get, you know, there's lots of water that falls on the state in a year with surface water, and some of that gets into the ground. And you're right that we have to have a system to manage that well into the future.
Senator Rummel.
So to follow up on that, are there plans to bring us information into the long-term future, both of groundwater and there's also I've got some concerns about groundwater contamination that is going from the Jordan Aquifer down into whether or not it can get into the Simon Aquifer. So there's a lot of complications that we need to be anticipating long into the future. Does the Met Council, do you have some plans to let us know what this long-term effect will be? And I'm concerned about global warming. How is that going to affect our water use and our water availability? Do we have any of that information?
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, we are working on some of those things. I mean, we don't have any specific reporting out planned, I guess. Let's see. Now I lost it. Mm-hmm. You know, the Met Council work, we're looking at, one of the things to look at with my council is how you deal with the waste treatment. If you expand the Metropolitan Services District, that starts to have water use implications. So we're talking with them on how we match all of these things, how we can put those types of growth demands on water together.
Seems like we should be doing that sooner rather than later.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I don't know if you're going to. You mentioned the conservation pricing, and we also changed the fee structure for appropriations. Is that part of your presentation, just to tell us?
Madam Chair, it was not. But last year, the legislature adopted a 50-cent increase, essentially, and I believe that generated about $500,000 of additional revenue.
All right. I think we'll probably have to have you come back on Thursday.
I expected so.
Okay. Then why don't we stop now, and then we'll get into the change items then. Thank you very much. And we'll see you Thursday. The meeting's adjourned.
I get to go to judiciary.